This is the Education Gadfly Show.
As a parent, you're like, oh, but he's so
he's happy watching 10 hours of TV.
I wouldn't go that far.
His brain's turned to mush, but darn, he's smiling a lot.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, the Daniel Patrick Moynihan of Education Policy, Leo Casey.
Good morning.
So, you know, that was, I came up with that, Leo, because, you know, of course, another famous New Yorker who came down to provide his expertise to Washington, as you have recently, a lifelong New Yorker, and you are now here at the Shanker Institute. How long have you been in D.C.?
About a year and a half now.
And is your impression that that House of Cards is very accurate about how things actually work in D.C.?
I rather like D.C. more Republicans than I'm used to. But, New York is a little different world in that respect.
That's funny. Although, of course, you know, for so long, New York was governed by Republicans or you know, whatever Bloomberg
well,
was.
Well, I yeah, whatever. Kind of political cross-dresser.
Well, I hope you enjoy being around us Republicans. And some of it's diversity, Leo. It spices things up. There's at least a more of a debate. You know?
Well, there once were Republicans that we New Yorkers loved, like Jacob Javits and Fiorello LaGuardia, but they seem to be a dead species at the moment.
Yes, they are referred to as rhinos these days. I fear that Ronald Reagan would be put in that category by some today as well. All right. Well, Leo, really appreciate you having you on the show here. It's going to be fun because, you know, oftentimes we have hosts where our disagreements are quite subtle. I think here we have some disagreements that are probably more fundamental. So that should be fun. So let's get started with Pardon the Gadfly.
New York Mayor Bill de Blasio has been facing criticism from the left and the right about his stance on charter schools, leading him to soften his rhetoric and reach out to what the New York Times referred to as charter groups more sympathetic to his administration. Is de Blasio having a change of heart or tactics?
All right. Now I know here that you, Leo, you know, as a New Yorker, have to be careful about commenting on what's happening back home in New York City. But this has been a fascinating thing to watch here in New York City. And as you see the charter thing playing out around the country, I mean, what's your take? I mean, where is this going? So, do you see the charter movement is going to keep just growing and growing and growing? What's your take?
Well, I think actually what you begin to see is some differentiation within the charter movement. And so there are charter schools and even some charter school organizations which are, I think, closer to the original vision of charter schools that inspired that, you know, the man was inspired by the man, Albert Shanker, whose name is on my institute.
Right.
And so I think you will see more and more folks who say charter schools should not be in the zero-sum game battle with district schools.
Yeah.
The charter schools should be a place where you do innovation. Charter schools should be a place where educators and community people can have a different sort of relationship to schools. And more, you will find that what has been up to now, I think, a kind of single voice coming out of charter school movement leadership, you will find some very different views. And I think that's part of what's happening in New York.
No, I will say, Leo, as somebody who is not a New Yorker, but does a lot of work in Ohio, you know, Ohio is a place where, we've been honest, has a lot of charter school quality problems that goes back to some very poorly designed policies. And so, you know, you have a legitimate argument in Ohio about charter quality. You look at New York and you say, wow, I mean, on the whole, the sector seems quite good, you know, and from quite good to some phenomenal schools, you know, some of which have that sort of community based feel, and some of which, you know, I think some critics of reform would call the corporate reform types, but, you know, which means what? That they are now larger networks. They're somewhat professionalized, but they're, by all accounts, very good for kids. They're very effective. So it's just interesting to me that, you know, how these debates play out differently, that I can understand a lot of pushback, say, in a place like Ohio, where, you know, on the merits, there's quite a few low quality charter schools, in a place like New York, where, you know, you look at it and you say, gosh, these kids are really, you know, doing well in these schools. I have a hard time saying that they should do anything but keep growing and helping more kids.
I think there's actually a paradox around a place like New York, which is the fact that there has been strong charter caps has actually forced the authorizers to make sure that they're only giving charters to quality, quality applications. And so the problem is that folks say, well, because they're strong, we should do like we do in Arizona, where it's the wild, wild west of charter schools.
No. They've cleaned that up quite a bit in Arizona. Arizona has gotten some more serious about quality. But yes, I understand your point. That's fair. I mean, I think that there is some evidence that those places that have had caps probably do have higher quality sectors. And then the question is, can you have so-called smart caps where you make sure that there is room for growth, particularly among the highest quality charter schools? There's still some room for innovation, new ideas that come along to somehow to get the balance right. But certainly just handing out charters willy-nilly, as happened once upon a time in Arizona, in Texas, in Ohio, turned out to be not such a great strategy. Okay, topic number two.
A big school funding decision has been made in Kansas. What are the implications there?
All right. So, Leo, this was interesting. You know, the Supreme Court in Kansas, first of all, it took pains to make it clear that it does have authority to weigh in on these things. And you can see that many conservatives saying, look, the court should stay out of these decisions. Kansas, like a lot of states, got hit hard by the recession. And in the depths of the recession, they cut spending on education. And the question was whether the legislature was allowed to do that or not. At also issue was that whether the way they cut the spending led to even greater inequities in the funding. And the court said, basically, you're not allowed to create these greater inequities, and you do have a constitutional responsibility to fund the schools, and sent it back to the lower court to kind of figure it out.
Yeah, I don't think Kansas is completely unique here. I think a lot of states have constitutional protections of one form or another for education. It was certainly a big issue in New York around the campaign for fiscal equity.
Yeah.
It actually resulted in court decisions which were followed for a period of time, and then when the recession hit, I suspect we'll be back in court. I think what's wise in terms of the Kansas decision is, rather than attempting to micromanage the actual financing, setting some bars that the legislature has to meet.
Yeah.
So let them do it in the way that they can, but tell them you really can't, in particular, take huge cuts out of urban school districts, which are serving mm-hmm. the neediest kids.
My understanding is they also, in the decision, talked a lot about outcomes, it's not just about spending. We're not going to just judge this based on coming up with some method to figure out how much money you have to spend. You know, folks like Eric Hanushek have argued for a long time that the way that people have tended to do that is not scientific. It's not based in real evidence, but to look at outcomes, to try to look at saying, are the kids, are you spending enough money in order for the kids to learn what they need to learn? And if they're not learning what they need to learn, that is some evidence that you're not spending enough, and there's this, it's, you gotta be careful with the circular logic here. Right. And as Hanushek said, you don't want to, sort of incentivize school systems for doing a bad job and saying, well, because so few of our kids are reading and doing math, we need more money. But there is some logic here still that says, look, at the end of the day, what the constitutional requirement is to provide whatever the language is, a sound basic education. And you can measure that based on whether kids are learning.
Yeah, I absolutely. That was in New York. What was very interesting was that the court said, what is actually required by a sound basic education? And they said, you need to be able to perform your civic duties.
Yeah.
So you need to know enough science that when you sit on a jury, you'll be able to look at different types of scientific evidence and be able to come to a reasonable decision. You need to have a level of civic knowledge where you can be a voter and actually, cast a ballot based on real issues and real knowledge. I think that sort of logic is the important logic here. So it's not just what are test scores and how are students performing mm-hmm. on test scores, but what are the civic knowledge That young people need to be, you know, citizens in a democracy.
Leo, we're agreeing too much. This is making me nervous. What's going on? All right, maybe in the last one we'll have some disagreements. Michelle, topic number three.
Diane Ravitch has a new post on the Huffington Post arguing that the reform narrative is a fraud. NAEP scores and graduation rates are at their highest point in history for both whites and minorities. The dropout rate is at a historic low, and so on. Does this progress prove that reform isn't necessary or that reform is working?
All right, Leo. So, you know, Diane's point is clearly that, hey, the schools are doing great. They're doing better than ever. Stop beating up on us. My take is, hey, that we're like 20 years into education reform. This shows that reform is actually working. We got to keep it going. What's your take?
My take is that it's very dangerous to try to draw policy conclusions from a really general and broad set of data. We had this with the NAEP scores. Where, you know, Washington, D.C., suddenly every policy that Washington, D.C. adopted was manna from heaven.
Right.
Because even though they're still dead last in the nation, they somehow, this cohort was better than the last cohort. And really, folks who are very serious about, you know, looking at and understanding this stuff say, yeah, you can't really draw policy conclusions.
Right, but that would go for Diane too, right? I mean, she's drawing a policy conclusion, which is that the education reform policies are wrongheaded and not needed. So so I guess you would say that that is not a fair conclusion to draw either.
I think people get into a dangerous kind of one-upsmanship game here. You know, the USDOE just got into this little mess around their turnaround schools because last year they had, you know, some uptick on standardized test scores, so it was a great success. This year, there was a downtick, and so they're trying to explain it away. But really, the fundamental problem is for folks who want to be serious about this stuff is that you shouldn't be what we call Miss Napery. You shouldn't be using NAEP scores to make policy statements.
I understand, Leo. And look, I've been reading your great blog on this stuff, and it's all well said. And I'm a huge fan of Matt DiCarlo, who writes for you. But look, I mean, clearly we have some historic trends, okay? And we're all, you know, we look at these trends and we say, look, okay, crime rates are down, test scores are up. I mean, we have these general, you know, labor market participation is down and the stock market is up. I mean, we look at these general trends and we try to make sense of them. And you're right that we have to be cautious and that the best thing we're doing is trying to make some guesses, hopefully some well-informed guesses, right? Something good is happening in terms of educational performance, at least at the fourth and eighth grade level. We have not generally seen as much progress at the 12th grade level. That's a big mystery why it's not shown up there. We do see some improvements in graduation rates. We hope that that means the kids are doing better, learning more. It could also be there's been, you know, things like credit recovery programs introduced that might be a factor there, right? Yeah. There's the economy. Kids might be saying, well, I might as well stay in school because there's no jobs anyways. I mean, so you're right. It's complicated. But, you know, decision makers do have to make decisions based on the best information out there. And it certainly seems like some of these trends are pointing in the right direction, that progress is being made, not necessarily fast enough, not as fast as is going to keep us, you know, make us globally competitive, perhaps with the best countries. We still have these huge achievement gaps, you know. But look, I think, you know, it is interesting that you have sort of the reform community and the reform critics looking at the same information, the same trends, and coming to vastly different conclusions.
I think they can do that because the sort of broad trends that you're looking at, they really don't provide us with information about specific policies.
Right.
I mean, there's one broad trend which, you know, I think is very critical, which is for the last 30 years growing economic inequality in the United States. That certainly has played out in terms of our public schools, where one in four kids live in poverty, one in two kids live in near poverty. You know, in terms of us being able to situate ourselves internationally, we need to be able to address that because other countries are doing a better job at that than we are. I don't completely want to vitiate the discussion of long-term trends, but I'm really I find it very suspicious if people are making arguments mm-hmm. one way or another.
Yeah.
For example, that using value-added measures in teacher mm-hmm. evaluation has been either proven a wise policy or proven a completely wrong policy
yeah.
based on yep. you know, some sort of data, test right. score data, graduation.
All
data.
Right. Well, I'm looking forward to your Huffington Post article saying Diane Ravitch is wrong on this one to make these claims. All right. Thank you, Leo. That's all the time we've got for Pardon the Gadfly. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
You heard Leo and I talking about that. People looking at these long-term trends and making all kinds of conclusions about it.
We like to look in our crystal ball around here, don't we? And reflect back and forward.
I know, but
it's so much fun.
But look, you got to be careful. But you also have to say, look, policymakers have to make decisions, right? And they have to make yes. decisions with the best information they've got. And they don't have perfect information.
That's so right.
There you go.
Nor do researchers, but they keep plotting ahead.
They do. That's why we need more research. Right. More research.
Good segue. We got a new NBER study. I like these kinds.
Yes.
It sheds light on why firstborn siblings tend to perform better in school. They test a nuanced hypothesis that posits that first or earlier born siblings put more effort in school and perform better than their later born siblings, partly because their parents are more strict with them. I know we're all thinking about mm-hmm. our own upbringing. They use data from the National Longitudinal Survey of Youth 1979, which contains info on all children born to women in the 1979 database, many of whom had two or more kids, which enables them to explore these birth order defects, as well as survey data on parenting techniques, which was really cool. They asked him all these questions mm-hmm. about parenting. They track outcomes for kids as they transition between the ages of 10 and 14. Three key findings. Number one, there's a clear association between school performance and birth order. For mm-hmm. instance, 34% of firstborns are considered one of the best in their class versus 27% of those coming fourth in the birth order. Mm-hmm. Similar pattern, 7% of firstborns considered bottom of their class compared to 11% of fourth born, so the pattern just switches. Early birth order is also associated with higher scores on standardized tests, math, and reading. They use the Peabody in this case. Mm-hmm. Number two, earlier born siblings grow up in a more regulated environment regarding TV mm-hmm. watching, and they face more strict parental monitoring of their homework. Mm-hmm. Number three, the more younger siblings a child has, the more likely are his parents to closely supervise him in the event that he brings home low performance on a report card. For instance, within a family of four, the firstborn is almost 7 percentage points more likely to have the parent be very likely to punish him upon bad grades relative to the lastborn. They control for a variety of confounding variables like family size and disruption in the family structure like mm-hmm. divorce. And they, end up, basically there's been a long line of this birth order research that shows that early born kids, firstborn perform better. And they're just trying to get into the black box. And I thought this was an interesting theory. Why this is happening.
Amber, where are you in the birth order?
Second. I had it so easy. Just skated free. My sister had all the rules and regulations. Yep. I had no curfew.
Yeah, I was the baby, the third, and the only boy in an Italian family. You do the math on that. Well,
I'm from a big Irish Catholic family, and I was 5 of 6.
Oh wow. Interesting. So, it's amazing any of us are here today. Right. That we can put a
Did
string
you get
a sentence together.
No trouble ever, right?
It is. Research like this, what's interesting about it is what do you do with it? Do you try to create more firstborns? Obviously, a little problem with that. It's kind of like, people who are taller command
yeah.
greater respect. It may or may not be true. I don't know what you do with it.
Yeah. Well, you can. I think part of it is you get to try to get to parents a little bit and just remind parents, hey, push us a bit. I've got two boys, 4 and 6. And I see it playing out like the TV yeah. thing. It's hard when very strict in those early years with Nico. Right. But then now, Nico, you start to get a little bit looser as he gets older and let him watch more TV. And then does a younger one get to watch it, too? Well, what's the option there? You try to, say, well, you 6-year-old can watch that show, but you 4-year-old can't. So I actually had a parent meeting last night at the preschool, and we were talking about this. How do you deal with, clearly our younger kids are getting exposed to sort of older kinds of TV shows than we had when we had the younger ones. And that plays out on all those issues you talked about. Same sort of deal.
Well, my mother simply didn't allow us to have the television in the house.
Wow.
And that's so impressive.
From you know, 1 through 6, we spent our youth reading books.
Wow, that's good. Yeah, that is good. Ugh, it's harder now. I would argue maybe I'm just feeling guilty with the iPads and the iPhones
everything else. Technology. Yeah.
Well, it's just everywhere, and it's a constant struggle to try to keep that out. You just, I don't know, over time you'd get tired as a parent.
Exactly. But I was thinking about it as a teacher, the opposite thing happens, right? I mean, my first year was a little more lenient.
Yeah.
The kids go wild. Yeah. The second year you're like so strict, you know? Yeah. So. Yeah. It just plays out in different ways.
Well, that is, you know, for novice teachers, that is, you know, the kind of vacillation between the extremes. Mm-hmm. You know, starting out, they're all going to love me because I love them.
Yeah.
And then, you know, when you discover that's not really how things work, you become the authoritarian. And hopefully, finally, you discover that there is a golden mean there
that
you can, you know, hit.
The big question, Amber, is, okay, they do better in school, but which kids are happier? Which are better adjusted?
Oh, here we go.
Right? It is, you know, because that's part of it as an adult. You're like, as a parent, you're like, oh, but he's so sweet.
10 hours of TV.
I wouldn't go that far.
His brain's turning to mush, but darn, he's smiling a lot.
He is. He's so sweet. He's so cute.
Sweet little dummy.
All right. Well, Leo, thank you so much for coming on the show. That is all the time that we've got for this week. So until next week,
I'm Leo Casey.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.